This is the 2009 WACE examination in English as an additional language dialect. Section 1, Listening. In this section, you are required to listen to two spoken texts and answer the questions that follow. You will hear each text twice. There will be a short pause at the start of each text to allow you to read the questions. You should either choose your answers while you are listening or make brief notes in the spaces provided to allow you to return to the questions at the end of the reading. Attempt every question. Remember, each text will be read twice. At the end of the second reading, you will be given time to complete your answers. Text 1 will begin in 2 minutes. Use this time to read the questions for text 1.
I am the first voice you will hear. I am the lecturer.
Text 1, First Reading.
In previous lectures, we have considered discrimination in terms of race and gender. In this lecture today, we will turn our attention to discrimination based on age. It is said that people age in 4 different ways. Firstly, there is what has been called chronological ageing. This just means that we measure someone's age in terms of the number of years they have been on the planet. This is the most common way that society measures age, as it is assumed that time is a reliable indicator of changes in the human mind and body. Another way to consider ageing is by looking at physical changes to our bodies. This is called biological ageing. 2 people can have the same chronological age, but very different biological ages, as we all know. Similarly, ageing can be measured by someone's psychological age. By psychological age, we mean age based on how old a person feels or believes themselves to be. All of us know people who behave in ways which seem younger because they see themselves as younger. Derogatory comments can often be heard about men and women who believe themselves still to be young and dress in a very young way. Finally, Age can also be seen from a social point of view. In other words, age is decided according to social behaviour. Young people who behave in more conservative ways are often judged to be older than those around them, while older people going to nightclubs might be seen to be younger than those who sit and watch TV every night. The question then remains, is chronological ageing the only way to measure age? Some would say that making rules according to chronological age cuts people off from many opportunities that would be open to them if ageing were judged on biological, psychological, or social age. This is particularly true when we look at the elderly. Many myths have been attached to ageing. One of these myths is that all old people are senile. Another myth is that all old people are sick. On the other side, old people are often stereotyped as serene and peaceful and therefore happy to sit and knit sweaters for their grandchildren or work in their gardens pruning roses. This myth is equally as damaging and discriminatory. Perhaps the myth which causes the most discrimination against old people, however, is the one that sees old people as unproductive, inflexible, and intellectually inferior. This myth is very dangerous, as it can lead to discrimination against old people in competitive environments, such as the workplace. Similarly, the common view of old people is that they're friendly but incompetent. Such views have been defined as ageist. The concept of ageism originally referred to prejudice and discrimination against old people. However, the definition of ageism has been expanded over time to include discrimination against workers of any age in the workplace. We can see increasingly that young people are often not selected for jobs because they look too young or are not considered to have enough life experience. In countries like the USA and the UK, discrimination against younger workers can also result in less pay for the same work. Although Australia passed an anti-discrimination law against such practices in 1994, wage rates are still set according to age in some workplaces. Discrimination based on age largely survives because of stereotypes which are handed down from generation to generation. In today's world, older people are generally physically and mentally fitter than ever before. They run marathons or climb mountains. They start university courses, travel a lot, become senior partners in businesses, and sometimes have children into their 50s. On the other hand, a woman of 30 can be at the end of her career and already a multimillionaire. Global changes have led to an increase in universal education, lifelong learning, and the wider distribution of knowledge. Added to this is the fact that many parts of the world are experiencing better nutrition, healthcare, and generally higher standards of living. To sum up, then, we can see that we are living in an age where effective running of workplaces can only really be achieved by ensuring age diversity in those workplaces. It makes sense for employers to have workers from all age groups in order to maintain a balance of skills in an organisation. Companies which adopt ageist policies, either directly or indirectly, will ultimately limit their chances of having the best people for the job.
Text 1. Second reading.
In previous lectures, we have considered discrimination in terms of race and gender. In this lecture today, we will turn our attention to discrimination based on age. It is said that people age in four different ways. Firstly, there is what has been called chronological aging. This just means that we measure someone's age in terms of the number of years they have been on the planet. This is the most common way that society measures age, as it is assumed that time is a reliable indicator of changes in the human mind and body. Another way to consider aging is by looking at physical changes to our bodies. This is called biological aging. Two people can have the same chronological age, but very different biological ages, as we all know. Similarly, aging can be measured by someone's psychological age. By psychological age, we mean age based on how old a person feels or believes themselves to be. All of us know people who behave in ways which seem younger because they see themselves as younger. Derogatory comments can often be heard about men and women who believe themselves still to be young and dress in a very young way. Finally, age can also be seen from a social point of view. In other words, age is decided according to social behaviour. Young people who behave in more conservative ways are often judged to be older than those around them, while older people going to nightclubs might be seen to be younger than those who sit and watch TV every night. The question then remains, is chronological aging the only way to measure age? Some would say that making rules according to chronological age cuts people off from many opportunities that would be open to them if aging were judged on biological, psychological, or social age. This is particularly true when we look at the elderly. Many myths have been attached to aging. One of these myths is that all old people are senile. Another myth is that all old people are sick. On the other side, old people are often stereotyped as serene and peaceful and therefore happy to sit and knit sweaters for their grandchildren or work in their gardens pruning roses. This myth is equally as damaging and discriminatory. Perhaps the myth which causes the most discrimination against old people, however, is the one that sees old people as unproductive, inflexible, and intellectually inferior. This myth is very dangerous, as it can lead to discrimination against old people in competitive environments, such as the workplace. Similarly, the common view of old people is that they're friendly but incompetent. Such views have been defined as ageist. The concept of ageism originally referred to prejudice and discrimination against old people. However, the definition of ageism has been expanded over time to include discrimination against workers of any age in the workplace. We can see increasingly that young people are often not selected for jobs because they look too young or are not considered to have enough life experience. In countries like the USA and the UK, discrimination against younger workers can also result in less pay for the same work. Although Australia passed an anti-discrimination law against such practices in 1994, wage rates are still set according to age in some workplaces. Discrimination based on age largely survives because of stereotypes which are handed down from generation to generation. In today's world, older people are generally physically and mentally fitter than ever before. They run marathons or climb mountains. They start university courses, travel a lot, become senior partners in businesses, and sometimes have children into their 50s. On the other hand, a woman of 30 can be at the end of her career and already a multimillionaire. Global changes have led to an increase in universal education, lifelong learning, and the wider distribution of knowledge. Added to this is the fact that many parts of the world are experiencing better nutrition, healthcare, and generally higher standards of living. To sum up then, we can see that we are living in an age where effective running of workplaces can only really be achieved by ensuring age diversity in those workplaces. It makes sense for employers to have workers from all age groups in order to maintain a balance of skills in an organisation. Companies which adopt ageist policies, either directly or indirectly, will ultimately limit their chances of having the best people for the job.
Text 2 will begin in 2 minutes. Use this time to read the questions for text 2.
I am the voice you will hear. I am the interviewer.
I am the voice you will hear. I am the firefighter.
Text 2 is an interview.
You're a firefighter, and you have a choice. Do you save the old person, who's relatively easy to save, or do you go for the child, when your attempt might not be successful, and you might lose your own life trying? Well, firefighting, the courage of firefighters, and to a more philosophical mind, the ethics of firefighters, have been much on all our minds lately. We look at the ethical dilemmas faced by those whose job is not only to fight fires, but also to rescue residents and to stay alive themselves. Let's talk to somebody in the hot seat. Keith Adamson has spent the past 36 years in the fire service, on the ground and behind the scenes. He's Deputy Chief Fire Officer for the Metropolitan Fire Board in Victoria, and he joins us now on the program. Now, Keith, you've got quite a history in the fire service, haven't you?
Yes. My father was a firefighter for over 36 years, and my older brother as well, and now my younger brother is. We used to live in fire stations when I was younger.
Okay. So, you speak with a long-standing authority on these subjects. Now, what sort of ethical considerations would firefighters have been confronting during the fires in Victoria?
Well, the first thing that springs to mind probably is the level of risk to which you put yourself in order to save other people. I mean, there's no point if an emergency worker of any sort goes to rescue a victim and finds themselves another victim. And our attitude is that a dead firefighter never saved anybody. And so you've got to weigh up that possibility of death or injury to the rescuer in order to rescue someone who may be in a difficult situation anyway.
What about people who don't want to be saved? What about residents who want to stay because they think they can protect their houses better by staying with them? Now, fires in Victoria are said to have moved very quickly. If a firefighter knows that somebody's in serious danger of death if they stay in their house, they haven't got the power to compel or force them to evacuate, have they?
No. And it will be very interesting to see what comes out of the Royal Commission regarding that. At the moment, anyone with a vested or financial interest can't be removed against their will. So even if they're choosing to stay to try and save their house or whatever, or their belongings, you can't forcibly remove them.
So, you sound as though you think perhaps you should be able to compel people to evacuate in certain circumstances.
Well, certainly I think a lot of people's judgment would be extremely impaired in some situations. And the classic case, for example, would be a parent trying to go back into a burning house to save their child. Do you try and restrain a person from doing it and then try and do it yourself? Or if it's too dangerous for anyone, what do you do?
You mentioned people staying in a property because they have, as you put it, a vested interest in the property. I presume they also might have a sentimental attachment to the property as well. Firefighters, of course, do also care for property, for the environment and other valuable items not directly related to the well-being of individuals, don't they? Does this become a tricky ethical juggling act as well?
Well, the charter, or the mission of most fire services in Australia now, includes the protection of life, property and the environment in the event of fires or other emergencies. At the moment, the fire services nationally are fighting the battle against the interests of people who want to make buildings cheaper to build and easier to build, because the current building code only contemplates life, safety and amenity. So the theory is that as long as people can get out of the building safely after a fire starts, and the fire's not going to spread to adjoining properties, then it doesn't matter if the building burns down. But our charter, of course, is to save the properties and to save the environment, and buildings which burn completely out have obvious implications for unemployment, the economy, the environment, and so forth. So it is again we see ourselves as being the good guys, if you like, because I don't think that debate has been had publicly, whether buildings should be allowed to be virtually disposable.
Let's look at triage when making quick decisions about who to save first or which group of people to save first. How do you consider just how you can get the most people out safely? What sort of considerations do you have to make? I mean, children versus adults, heavy people who might be difficult to save versus light people who might be easier. So you could save two light people instead of one heavy person. Presumably, these are all decisions that you have to make.
Certainly. And even decisions that you're not qualified to make, like who is more likely to survive than someone else. And so I think under extreme pressure and extreme circumstances, no matter how much training you've had, how much experience you've had, you're going to make decisions, I think, based on your own internal value. And people would probably rescue children, obviously, first, and make sure they were safe before rescuing an adult.
Do you think you're a different person when you've got your firefighter's hat on compared to the rest of the time? When you put the hat on, do you feel as well as the weight of the hat? Do you feel the weight of responsibility?
One of the most trusted professions in all of the surveys you see done, right up there alongside paramedics, is the firefighter profession. And I believe there is a very strong onus on us to honour that trust. So therefore, the public expects that firefighters will do the right thing all the time. We have to deal with people when they are at their lowest ebb. Now, the worst moment in their life might be your house fire. It might be a very small house fire to a firefighter, but the worst thing that happened to that family. But it also extends to whether you take sick leave when you're not sick, and whether you do the right thing in, I guess, doing the right thing with the money that the community gives you to run the fire service, so that you're not wasteful, and that you're giving the best possible value. And I think the community expects that, and that we should honour that trust.
Thank you very much for joining us today, Keith Adamson, Deputy Chief Fire Officer at the Metropolitan Fire Board in Victoria.
Text 2, second reading.
You're a firefighter, and you have a choice. Do you save the old person, who's relatively easy to save, or do you go for the child, when your attempt might not be successful, and you might lose your own life trying. Well, firefighting, the courage of firefighters, and to a more philosophical mind, the ethics of firefighters, have been much on all our minds lately. We look at the ethical dilemmas faced by those whose job is not only to fight fires, but also to rescue residents and to stay alive themselves. Let's talk to somebody in the hot seat. Keith Adamson has spent the past 36 years in the fire service, on the ground and behind the scenes. He's Deputy Chief Fire Officer for the Metropolitan Fire Board in Victoria, and he joins us now on the program. Now, Keith, you've got quite a history in the fire service, haven't you?
Yes. My father was a firefighter for over 36 years, and my older brother as well, and now my younger brother is. We used to live in fire stations when I was younger.
Okay. So you speak with a long-standing authority on these subjects. Now, what sort of ethical considerations would firefighters have been confronting during the fires in Victoria?
Well, the first thing that springs to mind probably is the level of risk to which you put yourself in order to save other people. I mean, there's no point if an emergency worker of any sort goes to rescue a victim and finds themselves another victim. And our attitude is that a dead firefighter never saved anybody. And so you've got to weigh up that possibility of death or injury to the rescuer in order to rescue someone who may be in a difficult situation anyway.
What about people who don't want to be saved? What about residents who want to stay because they think they can protect their houses better by staying with them? Now, fires in Victoria are said to have moved very quickly. If a firefighter knows that somebody's in serious danger of death if they stay in their house, they haven't got the power to compel or force them to evacuate, have they?
No. And it will be very interesting to see what comes out of the Royal Commission regarding that. At the moment, anyone with a vested or financial interest can't be removed against their will. So even if they're choosing to stay to try and save their house, or whatever, or their belongings, you can't forcibly remove them.
So, you sound as though you think perhaps you should be able to compel people to evacuate in certain circumstances.
Well, certainly I think a lot of people's judgment would be extremely impaired in some situations. And the classic case, for example, would be a parent trying to go back into a burning house to save their child. Do you try and restrain a person from doing it and then try and do it yourself? Or if it's too dangerous for anyone, what do you do?
You mentioned people staying in a property because they have, as you put it, a vested interest in the property. I presume they also might have a sentimental attachment to the property as well. Firefighters, of course, do also care for property, for the environment and other valuable items not directly related to the well-being of individuals, don't they? Does this become a tricky ethical juggling act as well?
Well, the charter, or the mission of most fire services in Australia now, includes the protection of life, property and the environment in the event of fires or other emergencies. At the moment, the fire services nationally are fighting the battle against the interests of people who want to make buildings cheaper to build and easier to build, because the current building code only contemplates life, safety and amenity. So the theory is that as long as people can get out of the building safely after a fire starts, and the fire's not going to spread to adjoining properties, then it doesn't matter if the building burns down. But our charter, of course, is to save the properties and to save the environment, and buildings which burn completely out have obvious implications for unemployment, the economy, the environment, and so forth. So it is again we see ourselves as being the good guys, if you like, because I don't think that debate has been had publicly, whether buildings should be allowed to be virtually disposable.
Let's look at triage when making quick decisions about who to save first or which group of people to save first. How do you consider just how you can get the most people out safely? What sort of considerations do you have to make? I mean, children versus adults, heavy people who might be difficult to save versus light people who might be easier. So you could save two light people instead of one heavy person. Presumably, these are all decisions that you have to make.
Certainly. And even decisions that you're not qualified to make, like who is more likely to survive than someone else. And so I think under extreme pressure and extreme circumstances, no matter how much training you've had, how much experience you've had, you're going to make decisions, I think, based on your own internal value. And people would probably rescue children, obviously, first, and make sure they were safe before rescuing an adult.
Do you think you're a different person when you've got your firefighter's hat on compared to the rest of the time? When you put the hat on, do you feel as well as the weight of the hat? Do you feel the weight of responsibility?
One of the most trusted professions in all of the surveys you see done, right up there alongside paramedics, is the firefighter profession. And I believe there is a very strong onus on us to honour that trust. So therefore, the public expects that firefighters will do the right thing all the time. We have to deal with people when they are at their lowest ebb. Now, the worst moment in their life might be your house fire. It might be a very small house fire to a firefighter, but the worst thing that happened to that family. But it also extends to whether you take sick leave when you're not sick, and whether you do the right thing in, I guess, doing the right thing with the money that the community gives you to run the fire service, so that you're not wasteful, and that you're giving the best possible value. And I think the community expects that, and that we should honour that trust.
Thank you very much for joining us today, Keith Adamson, Deputy Chief Fire Officer at the Metropolitan Fire Board in Victoria.
You should now complete your answers for this section. When you have finished, you may continue with the rest of the paper. Supervisors, please turn off the sound equipment.